Support for this program comes from Jazz on the Tube, the Internet's largest collection of free streamable classic jazz videos. From Miles Davis to Louis Armstrong, from Thelonious Monk to Duke Ellington, you'll find it all on jazzonthetube.com. Start your free subscription today.
Hi, and welcome to Jazz Talk, a Jazz on the Tube podcast. My name is Ken McCarthy, and this is where we talk with people who are doing important work that supports and illuminates the music we love. The writers, the scholars, the educators, the filmmakers, the producers, and more. Today we have a very distinguished guest who's going to be talking about a book that he's recently put out. You're going to love this book, and let's get right into his background. We're talking today with Hugh Wyatt. Welcome, Hugh.
Oh, thank you very much. It's my pleasure to be here.
And before the call, Hugh and I were talking about some of the many things that he's done. He was a reporter and columnist for the New York Daily News for nearly three decades. He was also one of the founders of WBLS Radio, and I'd like to talk about how that radio station and what it was. It was a very important cultural institution in New York City and how it came to be. And then let's also talk about the Apollo Theater, and then let's get into your book.
Okay. Well, I think in 1968-69, I joined with a group of people like Roberta Flack, the singer, Percy Sutton, he was a politician, and former mayor David Dinkins. And we thought that we needed a radio station that would be minority-owned, that would address the concerns of people of color in New York. As you know, New York is still full of people from all over the globe. And so we thought it would be a good idea. And so we proceeded with that. What's interesting is that we started BLS, I think it was about 1972-73, and our big surprise was that more whites ended up listening to the station than people of color, which we thought was fascinating, not just from a financial perspective, but something that would begin to relate to different interests, cultural interests. And since there's so many different cultural connections in New York City, we believe it was very important. One of the first results of WBLS was we were able to elect the first black mayor, which was David Dinkins. So WBLS stood for a lot of different things, a lot of important things, but most of all, it stood for harmony and bringing different cultures together, recognizing the value, the importance of them. And so in many respects, we symbolized New York City. I don't want to give us too much credit, but we were one of the, I think, key forces in New York that united a lot of different people.
I remember, I'm a little younger, but I remember that station. I remember how important it was. And yeah, New York, for people that don't know New York City, the whole world is in New York City. If you want to travel the world, you really just need to go to New York, and between Manhattan and the Bronx and Brooklyn and Queens, maybe a little Staten Island too, you're going to see the whole world. So you're going to meet somebody from every corner of the globe. And to represent that on the radio, I wish we had that station back.
That's what attracted me to New York, this global community, all these different cultures. And I loved them, and I still do. And I think that's what makes New York move. All the different nationalities, the different cultures, and not to mention the different foods, which I think is sort of bad news because I eat so much that I'm a little obese. And so that's the only negative. Otherwise, I love all the different foods.
Yeah, it's New York's a food paradise and a music paradise. Hey, can you tell us a little bit about your work at the Apollo Theater?
Well, we purchased the Apollo Theater. I was not directly involved, but we knew of the historic significance of the Apollo, And so we think it also played a major role. And we acknowledge the history and how all the greats had played it, the Apollo. And the Apollo was sort of a testing ground for new talent. And if you could play well, or if you had some talent, the Apollo was the place to be. And I think we carried on that tradition. And I think most people know about the heavies who played there, from Duke Ellington to Sarah Vaughan, Ella Fitzgerald, and a lot of very great musicians. So I guess the Apollo was probably as much of a testing ground as Minton was for bebop. I think the only difference, Ken, is Minton's focused strictly on bebop. The Apollo focused not only on bebop, but on virtually every aspect of culture. I think probably with the exception of country and western, you could hear all these different musical sounds and styles at the Apollo.
And it was an audience, as you mentioned earlier, that if you could win over the Apollo audience, you really had something.
Oh, absolutely. That was the incredible thing about it. And, you know, I have to make a confession here that there was a fellow who ran the Apollo. He was the manager. I'm having a senior moment now. But I discovered later that he was a major movie star back in the 1930s and 40s.
Oh.
I'll think of his name in a few minutes. But he played a major role in directing the Apollo. And I think that he understood culture, especially black culture, and he understood not only the music, but he also understood the theater. He understood films, and God, I can't think of his name, but I'll think of it before this interview is over.
Sure. Was the Apollo in danger of disappearing at one point?
Oh yeah, very much so. I think
really.
Because you know, you've got to constantly do things to attract newer and younger audiences. And I think that many of the people running it, and I played a very key role in BLS and introducing that and helping to maintain it, but not so much with the Apollo. Mm-hmm. And I think that maybe some of the managers may have taken the Apollo for granted and not realized that you've got to constantly reach out to new people, to mm-hmm. new audiences. And in fact, I think this is the role for jazz itself. I don't know that jazz has continued its quest to reach different audiences. And jazz is a very international music. And in my book, may I plug that for a second?
Oh, you know what? Before you do, let me plug it. Let me personally plug it. The book that Hugh is talking about, his most recent book, is called Sonny Rollins Meditating on a Riff, A Journey into His World of Spirituality. And I love it when somebody takes the time to reveal and illuminate the life of our great musicians. Because something I like to say is that this music, you know, a lot of us hear it in a disembodied form. You know, we hear it on a record or a CD or on the radio. Maybe we see a video. But this music's not disembodied. It comes from human beings. And these human beings have amazing life stories and amazing life lessons to share with us. And somebody like Sonny Rollins has a lot of stuff to share for us. And without people like you to go through the great effort to document these individuals' lives, especially while they're still living, we wouldn't know. We wouldn't know the story. And so this is it's a great read. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you very much.
Oh, yeah. It's almost every page had something that made me go, wow, I didn't know that. And it really gave me a feeling for Sonny's life. So I'm sorry. So go ahead. You were saying something about.
Well, I think, shall I go into the different aspects of the book now, or shall I hold off?
Oh, yeah, we could do that. Let me do a really quick intro on the book. And what I came away from this book is that Sonny Rollins' life was messy, it was mystical, and it was majestic, and is all those things. And all of us managed to have a messy life. We were all able to do that without any special talent.
Absolutely.
Right, exactly. And yeah. Now, some of us attempt to penetrate the veil and understand the larger context of life, the mystical context of life. Very few of us attain anything that could be called a majestic life. And I don't think anybody who knows Sonny Rollins and Sonny Rollins' career and his work and his life doubts it when I say Sonny Rollins has attained a majestic life. So this book documents all three of those aspects of his human life, the messy, the mystical, and the majestic. So yeah, Hugh, anything you want to say about the book to let people know what's in it, I'd really appreciate it.
Well, I think that, you know, for the first time, well, let me give you a quickie background about me and Sonny. I met Sonny back in the 1960s, and for almost over two decades, close to three decades, I thought I knew Sonny. We talked about jazz, we talked about women, we talked about even fashions, because Sonny loved French clothes, and we would even go shopping. But you know, a few years ago, I began to really fully and truly understand the real Sonny Rollins. Mm. And Sonny was very much into yoga, which I knew very little about. He was very much into Buddhism, which I knew very little about. So because of his interest in these subjects and other subjects such as Rosicrucianism, I began to do a lot of study on these different, other, what I call otherworldly subjects, religions, cultures, or whatever you want to call them. And by studying them, I think for the first time, I really understood the true, the real Sonny Rollins. Mm. And, you know, for example, one of the things that fascinated me was the type of Buddhism that was so pervasive. And of course, yoga also. Here's the thing that really struck my fancy. Coltrane, and not so much Sonny, but Coltrane and a lot of the other pioneers of spirituality and jazz, they embraced something called Kriya Yoga. Now, I was watching a documentary on, I don't know if you've seen the television series about, Mars and cosmic travel and so forth. But what's interesting is that this field of yoga is it's not known by too many people, but it deals with cosmic travel and all sorts of far out things. Now, let me make a point, Ken, that I'm an old fashioned Christian and I embrace Christianity to the fullest, but I love and respect all these different forms of spirituality. I think that like Sonny says that all of them have an element of truth, that there's only one truth. And I agree with that principle, but the piece last night, the documentary, showed how Steve Jobs used Kriya Yoga to get to where he was through meditation and a lot of other things. And he wasn't the only one who embraced Kriya Yoga. I believe that Coltrane and all of the people had some connection to that. Now, here's something that's really fascinating, and I only discovered this within the last year or two. I spent a lot of time talking to Sonny Rollins' nephew, the great trombonist Clifton Anderson.
Mm-hmm.
And Clifton told me something that was really, really fascinating. Okay, Ken, I'm going to make a confession that I have certain prejudices which I've been trying to deal with all my life, and I think all of us do. Some of them are severe and mean. Mine have been subtle. Now, one of them was that I never realized just how soulful, how beautiful Japanese people are, that they have a kind of beauty, inner beauty, that completely blew me away. And it took Clifton to give me the full explanation. In other words, here's the point. Here's the prejudice. People say that Japanese people are major cloners, that they're not major innovators. That's not true at all. Sonny understood this three, four decades ago, and so he's been dealing with this aspect of Japanese culture. And I think what I try to do in the culture on Nippon Soul, in the chapter in the book, is to tell people just how important Japanese culture is and how the Japanese are major innovators. They are not cloners.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And so that's a serious prejudice. And it took me a long time to realize this. And so I've been spending some time with Masuo who played with Sonny. I don't know if you remember him or not. Do you?
I don't.
Great musician, guitarist, and he was part of the Japanese jazz scene. And so I guess I've become very much involved with Japanese culture. Now, here is another aspect that I think is important. There's a chapter in my book called The Veil, which deals with Sonny's trip to, quote, heaven, unquote. And it taught me something about, and this is going to sound a little sort of weird, but I'll tell you anyway, Ken.
Okay.
I guess you all know about Saint Bernadette and the south of France, about Lourdes, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, there was Sonny experienced something about 40, 50 miles away in France, and I don't want to talk too much about this chapter because I'd love for people to read it, mm-hmm. but it focuses on an area that has some spiritual connotation. And I should also point out that France played a very dominant role in the history of jazz. Very few people know it, but jazz musicians were playing on the concert stage in France in the early 1900s. And it took, I think, probably the 20s or 30s for jazz to be recognized as a serious art form, something to be acknowledged by scholars and academics. And so France had an early start. And I have to tell you that I was blessed in the 1960s and 70s. I spent a lot of time with a lot of expatriates living in Europe, especially in France. I got to know people like Kenny Clark, and Art Taylor, the drummer, became a very close friend of mine, and he gave me some historical perspectives, which I don't think have really ever come out. But anyway, I don't want to lose sight of the spirituality aspect.
Sure.
I would say that with respect to spirituality, the French are very, very much into spirituality. I don't know that they are as much into organized religion as they were at one point, but I would say that they were among the leaders of spirituality. So when you look at places, and here's another point, back to Japan. Japan has a population of about 128, 130 million people, mm-hmm. and 40 million plus are Buddhists. And so they fully embrace. So you've got this large percentage of people, and guess what? These are the big proponents of jazz.
Mm-hmm.
So the bottom line is, whether it's Native American spirituality, and Charlie Parker was very much into spirituality, and it would take me 10 hours to talk to you about the spirituality of the Cherokee people. The correct name, of course, is Salagi, and Choctaws. Now, Charlie Parker was very much into that, as was Oscar Pettiford. Now, these are among the two dominant spirituality people, and the founders of bebop. So mm-hmm. if you look at the spirituality of the Choctaw, the Cherokee people, you'll begin to see it. And what's even more interesting, Ken, is, and I would like to write a book about that, is how Native American spirituality had its impact on jazz. Now, Dizzy Gillespie was the high. And here's something else that would be surprising to a lot of people. It might be a little controversial, but I think it's very important. Mary Lou Williams, in my view, was the key founder of bebop. Now, let me tell you why I say that. Mary Lou Williams was an academic. She was quite brilliant, and she was the one who sat around at a hotel called the Braddock Hotel in Harlem. This was before Minton's took off. All the guys would sit around, and they would talk about the music, they would hum it, and they would actually use this hotel as a testing ground. Now, what's important about Mary Lou is that she was a very heavy-duty Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
So we look, in all due respect, to all these great foreign cultures, Buddhism, yoga, and so forth and so on. We can't forget that Christianity, you know, played a dominant role as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, many of the musicians used Christianity initially to launch Jazz. And I guess the whole point of the book, Ken, from my perspective, and I hope I succeeded, but perhaps I did or I did not, but it was my intention to recognize the glory, the world itself, the different cultures and the role different people played. And I think that when you look at France, for example, and, oh, here's a, let me give you a further explanation. If I'm talking too much, you know.
No, you know, they say it's music to my ears. This is a dimension of the music that we should all, we would all benefit from knowing more about. So any direction you want to go in is fine. And just to remind everybody, we're talking with Hugh Wyatt. He's the author of a new book, Sonny Rollins, Meditating on a Riff, A Journey into His World of Spirituality. Super bio of Sonny Rollins through the lens of his spirituality, and Hugh's talking about this element of spirituality in jazz on an even larger scale right now. So yeah, please go ahead.
Okay, so you know, I think that people with a universal mindset might find some interest in the book. I think if you're sort of shallow and you just believe in one particular perspective, whether it's your own religion, it doesn't mean that you can't. You know, I'm a very strong Christian. I believe very strongly in Christianity, but I see the love and I see the beauty in all these different religions. I think Buddhism blows me away, and even Kriya Yoga, although I don't agree with a lot of things about Kriya Yoga, but I think that when you look at the spirituality, the depth, you look at Indian music, Indian music is beautiful. It would take me forever to try to explain what little I learned. But, you know, the fact that Sonny Rollins went to India to get a firsthand impression and knowledge of the music, I think that greatly enhanced his approach. And, of course, when you go back to, let me capsule it by saying this, that Sonny believes in a lot of different forms of spirituality. He's into the Kabbalah, a lot of different things. But his two dominant things are yoga and Buddhism. Mm-hmm. So when you listen to his music, you hear these elements, these influences in the music. And we all know how spirituality, especially yoga, was to the Beatles. The mm-hmm. Beatles took the spirituality of the world, along with rock and roll, some good old-fashioned rock and roll, and created what I think is perhaps one of the most important periods or fusions of music. They understood Kriya Yoga. They understood Buddhism. And you know what's even more interesting, Ken, something that I discovered, is that Christianity has a lot of spirituality elements. Christians were very, very much into meditation at one point. And by the way, mm-hmm. meditation is key. So mm-hmm. with all the little-minded people who think their perspective is correct, their one perspective is correct, they're absolutely wrong. They need to explore the music of Sonny Rollins. They need to explore, and here's a plug for my book, forgive me.
But they That's
need
okay.
to, they need to explore the book, because the book attempts, and I don't know if it was that successful, because to be honest with you, Ken, you know, I'm not an expert in Buddhism. I'm not an expert in yoga, especially Kriya Yoga. Kriya Yoga is really, really far out. And some of these things require a lot of study. So for me, it's only been maybe 2-3 years of study, and I can guarantee you it's not sufficient for me mm-hmm. to be an expert. So what I try to do is touch superficially on what I've learned, and I've tried to connect it with bebop. Now, I'm not an expert on bebop or jazz, but what I do know is what I was able to do, combine both worlds. Mm-hmm. I think that a key component of the book is the history of bebop. Now, what is crucial about bebop is that, unlike other, okay, let me interrupt myself and make this point.
Okay.
And bebop musicians were really arrogant, they were cocky, and they were among the first blacks to be well-educated. So they were not obsequious with the audiences. They really, many of them didn't care what the audiences thought. they were about playing the music. They were about being creative, which I love. And this is one of the great things that I love about bebop. So when they embarked on going into a world of spirituality, that really intrigued me. And I think they were the defining people. I think that prior to the bebop people, and I love Duke Ellington, and Duke Ellington, by the way, was quite daring himself, but I think a lot of the musicians, the swing musicians, were more concerned about pleasing audiences rather than pleasing themselves and pleasing the creative juices within them. And mm-hmm. I think without these creative juices, these independent juices, you're not going to really be able to get anywhere. So the reason Charlie Parker is still relevant, and I was just listening the other day to his album, Charlie Parker with Strings. I guess you're familiar with that.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, and it was so beautiful, the melodies, and it sounds as if he recorded it yesterday. You know, so yep. Anyway, I'm talking too much, Ken, so let me shut up and let you ask some questions.
Well, you raise an interesting and important point in the book. You not only talk about Sonny's seeking, but also John Coltrane and other musicians. And that's a dimension to a lot of these great musicians. Not only were they masters of the art of music and the art of jazz, which is, you know, one of the most demanding art forms there is. You know, I always, you know, always say jazz is the art form you can't rest on. You know, you can't write a big novel and live off it the rest of your life. You got to appear on the stage, not every night necessarily, but from time to time, and you have to show that you still have it. It's an art form that you can never rest on. You always have to be developing yourself. So in addition to their musical work, which was profound, and people don't know, all these guys practice every day. You know, people need to know that. Sonny, Sonny's a little older now. I'm not sure what his daily work is like, but I'm sure throughout the entire course of his life, he was practicing every day. And I remember somebody asked Maxine Gordon, Dexter Gordon's widow, what did Dexter do at home? He said, well, he watched TV and he practiced. And I think that might be shocking to fans. It might even be shocking to younger, you know, student musicians that this, you even after you attain the height of a Dexter Gordon or a John Coltrane or a Sonny Rollins, you're still working at your craft. It's such a beautiful example to all of us. But this other dimension that's in your book, Sonny Rollins Meditating on a Riff, is not only were they working on music, they were also seekers, right? They were heavy duty, dedicated, serious seekers after the truth, and they went in whatever direction they felt was fruitful. Could be Kriya Yoga, could be Buddhism. In Mary Lou Williams' case, it was Christianity, specifically Catholicism.
Absolutely.
And Dizzy, the Baha'i faith. And then when we look at the roots of the music, you can't have jazz, you can't have blue, you can't have any of this music without the music of the church.
You need the spirituality. I mean, that's crucial.
Yeah.
The music lacks substance if you don't have some sort of belief system, in my opinion. But go ahead. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you, Ken.
Oh, no, not at all. And you made the point also about, well, let me just say this. You were starting to talk about Mary Lou's supreme importance in the development of bebop. And one of the many things I loved about your book, when there was a point in your book where you listed all the important pioneers of bebop, and you listed Mary Lou Williams first. And in my opinion, that was absolutely correct.
Thank you very much. A lot of people have disputed that, by the way. But go ahead.
No. They shouldn't dispute that. And let me go off on my own tangent on this. Mary Lou was older than all those young guys. They were young at the time. Bud was young.
Yes.
Monk was young. And Mary Lou was already a serious veteran. She had come out of Kansas City, where she held her own, which is unbelievable. I mean, even today, for a woman musician to go into an environment like that and hold their own is not an easy thing. You've got to be beyond the beyond to be able to hold your own as a woman in the music world. That's just a fact. It's harder for them.
She was an early feminist. She didn't take any crap from the sexism of these musicians, and that was rampant.
Right. Oh, my God. Could you imagine? I mean, we know what it's like today. It's not great today. Could you imagine what it was like in the 30s in It was rough. Oh my God, I can't even imagine. But her, the quality of her character and the quality of her musical attainment was so high that they had to respect her. So when she came to New York, she had already gone through about 10 years of that. She wasn't in her 20s anymore, and all these young guys who were seekers, they needed the musical sophistication that she brought. She was more musically sophisticated than these young guys. It's not taking anything away from any of them. They were young.
Absolutely.
So who did they go to get that sophistication? We know the history. They went to Mary Lou Williams' apartment and they hung out around the piano and she showed them things. Now they took that and ran with it and created amazing stuff. But I think if you take Mary Lou Williams out of the equation, we wouldn't have had bebop the way we had it. I just don't think it would have happened.
And you're absolutely correct. In fact, could I name drop for a moment?
Please, please.
I was really, really blessed. Mary Lou's brother, Mr. Shrug, I forgot his first name, but he taught me in the third grade.
Wow.
And I remember at the age of 8 or 9 years old, I had mentioned somehow, I can't remember exactly, I mentioned jazz, I especially mentioned Duke Ellington. And then he started telling me about his sister. And so this was back in the early 50s, late 40s, early 50s. And so I was lucky, so I started listening to her because of Mr. Shrugs, who was a pretty good teacher. And he taught me about the value of math, about physics, and then so he gave me my background. Now, what else is interesting is that Cab Calloway's brother was like the truant officer in the school, and I was a bad and I was a bad boy one day, and he put me in detention.
Uh-oh.
You know, and so a few years later, I think at the age of 14, I met this beautiful girl in Atlanta at my school. And I fell in love with her. And so she invited me to go to Chattanooga, Tennessee. So believe it or not, at the age of 14, 15, I got on a train. I had made some money. I was always working. And so I went to Chattanooga, and her father was a great jazz lover, and he had played jazz himself. I forgot the instrument, but he introduced me to Jimmy Blanton's mother. Now, just for your listeners who don't know who he is, Jimmy Blanton was the guy who created the role of the bass. Prior to Jimmy, the bass was just sort of an accompanying instrument. But Jimmy did some things. And by the way, I'm going to make another plug. Around this time, there was a teacher in Atlanta by the name of Wayman Carver. And Wayman Carver also was one of my mentors. Wayman changed the role of the flute. He basically introduced the flute with Chick Webb's band and showed how it could be played as a solo instrument.
Mm.
And so we often talk about why Max Roach was so great and how Max turned the drums into a solo instrument, not just to keep time. So Jimmy Blanton introduced the bass as he was playing some licks similar to what Pettiford played, what Paul Chambers played. Well, Blanton was doing this.
Right.
So she taught me about these things. So I have to say, forgive me for name dropping, Ken, but, you know, I've been blessed to have known all these people. And I have to make one other point, that my brother was the boyfriend of John Coltrane's cousin, Mary. And Mary was Coltrane's dominant influence, by the way.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So I didn't know Train that well. I just sort of knew him superficially, although I did know Sonny extremely well.
Mm-hmm.
But I was sort of part of this cultural revolution, this new cultural revolution in the East Village in the 1960s. But let me stop talking so much. That could be another interview about the Lower East Side, Ken.
We might need to do that. We might need to have you back many times because there's so many areas you've touched on. You know, that Lower East Side culture of the 60s was so important. It was It was kind of like Athens, you know, in classical Greece. And in terms of what it produced, in terms of art and artists, that's a whole topic. The whole topic of the Native American contribution to jazz, which I don't think one out of a million jazz fans is aware of. But you mentioned Oscar Pettiford. You could have mentioned Sonny Murray.
Oh, Sonny was a good friend of mine. Close.
Yeah, and Sonny will tell you straight up, swing comes from the Native people.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Beat, and that's shocking. If you tell the average jazz fan the swing beat comes from Native Americans, they'll go, what? That's crazy. By the way, just I don't know, if have you had a chance to see this movie called Rumble?
No, I haven't, but I'd like to get to it, though.
I'll tell you, for you and for everybody, it will put goosebumps on your arms because it gets deep into this issue of the Native American contribution to all of American music, to jazz, to blues, and to rock and roll. And you know, we were talking about Mary Lou Williams earlier, and you know, very few people are aware of how important she was to bebop. And we said if you take Mary Lou out of the equation, we might not have those musics the way we know them. This film makes the point, and I think they prove the point, that if you take the Native American aesthetic out of American music, there'd be no blues. Jazz would be very different, and rock and roll would be a little weaker.
Well, I don't know it, but my father was Cherokee and Muscogee, and my mother was Cherokee and Black. So I understand, and I just lectured on what you're talking about 2 weeks ago on a reservation in Southampton, New York, called Shinnecock.
I'll send
you a copy of the piece.
Oh, I'd love that. I'd love that. Because I'm hoping that this decade, we've got two more years left, but I'm hoping that with this film and you and people like you and I talking, that this is the year or the decade that people get it, or serious fans get that you've got to include the Native American picture to really understand our American music. It's not a minor influence. It's not a thing off by the side. It's right in the heart and soul of the music that we love. And I want to encourage everybody to see Rumble, by the way. Hey, I'm going to switch gears a little bit, if you don't mind,
sure.
away from the spiritual to the basically gritty reality of Sonny's upbringing. You know, it was not an easy neighborhood to live in initially, you know, where he first started. And, you know, what was life like for a young man in that era, in that neighborhood, in that cultural context? I mean, for example, one of the things that I was, I guess, not surprised about, but I was like, oh, I didn't realize that Sonny was a heck of a boxer.
Oh, he was tough.
Yeah, let's talk about it. Now why did, you know, we think of him as a very creative, sensitive man, which he is, of course, but he also had that by necessity, because you had to have that. I mean, I grew up in the Bronx. You can't be a fool in the Bronx. You know, you better at least be able to run fast.
Yeah, you got to know what to do. Yeah.
You have to know what to do. So what let's talk a little bit about the forces surrounding him as a young person.
Okay. Well, I think Sonny originally lived in the tough part of Harlem, and eventually he moved to Sugar Hill. This is mm-hmm. where all the wealthy blacks were, the notables, Thurgood Marshall, Duke Ellington, Count Basie, Du Bois. But prior to that, he lived in a very rough area. And but let me give you some history about Sonny that I think is key. Sonny's he had a very famous uncle. I forgot his first name. I'm having a senior moment now, but Sonny has some strong, people see Sonny as being having his roots in St. Thomas, and that's true in St. Croix, but they also go back to Haiti.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll think of it in a moment, but Sonny used a lot of ethnic Haitian culture to develop his style, and then he evolved into to the music of St. Thomas, St. Croix. But anyway, back to your point, Ken. Harlem was pretty rough, and Sonny had to survive. I mean, he was surrounded by a lot of crime, and then, unfortunately, I hate to talk about this, but a lot of the musicians were drug addicts. Yes. And I think I'm careful about playing the role of psychiatrist or therapist, but I think that a lot of the musicians chose drugs because they didn't have the antidepressants back then. And so they were, you know, a lot of them suffered from racism, black musicians, and, you know, other people, I mean, Jews, for example, suffered greatly. And so, and these are the two dominant groups. That's not to shut out the great other ethnic groups like the Irish Catholics. They played dominant roles. But the two dominant groups were people who were really oppressed, and that's African-Americans or blacks and Jews. Mm-hmm. So, and you had these two groups in Harlem because both groups were ostracized. And so Sonny grew up in this element. And what's even more interesting is, and this is something that I think I didn't really talk about it so much, but I should in the future. Jews were the dominant patrons. They were in the clubs. And they were, you're looking at the Bohemians and you're looking at black intellectuals. So this is something that is rarely talked about, but the early fans and were the Jewish intellectuals, the Bohemians, the black intellectuals, the Bohemians. So these are the people who represented the core of the jazz audience. Mm-hmm. And I think that many of the musicians were themselves intellectuals. You know, long before they started going into spirituality, you know, they were reading Nietzsche and Charlie Parker could, I think, tell you the difference between Schopenhauer and Hegel. You know, so you're looking at this type of musician. So, but to get back to the point you made, Sonny was surrounded by this world, you know, and he was surrounded by, I hate to put it this way, a lot of thugs, a lot of tough guys. And I remember a story, I don't know if I mentioned it in the book, but Art Taylor, the drummer, he was a womanizer, a good-looking guy, tall, smooth, and he was hitting on everybody in sight. If you wore a dress, Art would hit on you. And he was presumptuous enough one day to hit on Sonny Rollins' sister, Gloria. Mm. And I think that was the last hit he made. I don't know exactly what happened, but Art was a very close friend of Sonny. But I think Art was a little sort of, he was afraid of Sonny. Sonny had some, you know, Sonny's a powerful man. And you could hear it in his music. His music is powerful. His music was powerful. And his persona was powerful. Everything about Sonny was powerful. And he could, this is what helped him survive on the streets.
And let's talk a little bit about the fact that Sonny was sort of a junior member of the bebop revolution. He was a little bit younger than Charlie Parker, obviously, and Bud Powell and Monk. What was his relationship? I think people might be surprised to know how much exposure young Sonny had to really good music early in his life.
Okay, let me give you some evolution here, Ken. Sonny was born in 1930. Okay, and bebop started probably in the late 30s. And it was around this time, around 42, 43, that all the guys would get together. And by the way, keep in mind that Coleman Hawkins and Charlie Christian had already started exploring bebop back in the late 30s.
But, sure.
It didn't really come to fruition until probably around 42, 43. And that's when all the guys would hang out at the Braddock Hotel and other places. And that's when, and they would end up at Mary Lou's apartment. What they would do is they would play all night. And believe it or not, they weren't satisfied with playing. So they ended up at her apartment. And so she started teaching a lot of these guys how to read. Now, so around 1942-43, Sonny was listening to the music. He was surrounded by all these guys, you know, the Parkers, the Dizzys, the Bud Powells, and the Monks, and so forth. And his probably greatest strength was his relationship to Monk. And by the way, let me interrupt myself and make a point. Sonny has pulmonary problems and he can't play his horn today. But guess what he does? He practices on his piano. And guess who he sounds like? He sounds like Monk.
Uh-huh. Oh, wow.
I
believe it.
Like,
of course.
Yeah.
I believe
like
it.
So, but so Monk, So Monk was his, was sort of the, even the guru back then. So around 1945, Monk was considered the man by most of the guys, you know? And so they all hung around Monk and Bud Powell, who continues to be my favorite pianist, by the way.
Mine too.
And Pettiford. And that's when the Native influence came. I don't know if you heard of, what was his name, John Simmons, the bass player. John was Cherokee also. And he had a lot of, you see, one of the problems back then, and it continues to this day, is Native people are not recognized as sufficiently as African Americans, but they were pretty much one and the same. And now let me make another point, which I think is crucial too. Let's talk about Jews for instance. Jews were major composers, and not only were they major composers, but this is really key. When musicians, this is really important here, Ken. A lot of the musicians abandon their respective religions to become spiritual. When you'd ask musicians back in the 40s and 50s, especially the 60s, you'd say, what is your religion? They would say, I'm spiritual. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So here's the spirituality connection. When African Americans started embracing spirituality, many of them abandoned Christianity. Okay. Now, let's make a contrast here. When many Jews started to abandon Judaism, they really didn't totally abandon it. They got into something called Buddhism.
Mm-hmm.
And if you would check out Buddhism, you would find that there is a strong connection between Judaism and Buddhism. And
wow.
So,
okay.
Yeah, it's really heavy duty. And that's why, so Jews could connect on two fronts. They could connect with the African-American front, and they could connect with the Asian thing, the Buddhism. And to me, Sonny Rollins, and he'd kill me if you heard me say it, but of his spirituality, the two dominant spiritual entities are Buddhism and yoga. And it's terrible for me to categorize someone. I know people who are listening to this will say, how can you dare put him in a box like that? But I'll do it anyway at my risk, at my peril.
Okay. We're just trying to...
About the bebop period?
Yeah, we're just trying to understand, you know, best we can. We have to start with categories, you know, and then we make our categories more sophisticated over time, hopefully. But I guess my point is that Sonny, as a teenager, knew these guys.
Yes, he did. Yes. Monk was his mentor. See, he would go to Monk's house, and all the guys would hang out there.
Young Sonny was part of the scene. He was the, you know, proverbial fly on the wall, kind of checking everything out and soaking it in. So I guess that's to take this full circle. You know, the music, you know, we hear it on the records or on the radio, maybe a video if we're lucky. And we can make the mistake that it's disembodied, you know, that it's just sort of coming from the airwaves. No, it comes from human beings, and these human beings have lives and struggles and stories. And I think it's so valuable for people to understand the details of these stories, which you've done so beautifully in Sonny Rollins Meditating on a Riff. You know,
I appreciate that.
I loved it, man. I was going through some very difficult times in my personal life when your book arrived, and reading it and hearing about what Sonny went through, you know, because he had some dark times, no question about it. And to see how he got, you know, he came through the other side stronger. That was a major, that's a whole nother element to this book, by the way, for people that are interested in getting it. And I really encourage, if you love jazz, you've got to get this book. But the point is, this music's not disembodied. It comes from specific human beings that have specific life stories and life struggles. So, and the other important point is that there's no such thing as an individual artist that appears out of the blue. They come out of a culture. They come out of a community. They come out of a specific context. So Sonny was hanging out with Thelonious Monk's apartment when he was a teenager and seeing Bud Powell and Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie come and go. And this had obviously had a deep imprint on his soul and was a guiding principle for him as he was developing as an artist.
Yeah, he was, I think, what he, more so than anything, I think he carried on their legacy.
Yes.
Of course, he's created his own legacy now. During this time, he was learning their legacies, which were great legacies. And they were. And by the way, let me make another point, too. There were so many different subcultures within that culture.
Mm-hmm.
Sonny and a lot of musicians had that Caribbean mindset. And
mm-hmm.
Caribbean people played a very dominant role in the creation of bebop.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, it was another point I wanted to make. If I could just digress for a second and go back to Coltrane for a minute.
Please,
with his spirituality. You know, one of the things that I learned about Coltrane, and I think if you were to make a distinction between the two, and I know I'm dealing with something very, very sensitive here in comparing these two men, because you've got the diehard Sonny Rollins fans, and then you got the Coltrane fans. And these people are like really very fanatical about who they consider to be the man, so to speak. But
sure.
Let me tell you what is interesting. If I were to make a major distinction between the two, is Sonny had been a Zion AME and the other Caribbean church. Again, I'm having the senior moment. Forgive me. When
mm-hmm.
you get to be an old man, you get these things. The Moravian Church, it's called Moravian.
Uh-huh. Moravian, okay. Yep.
So, now, what's interesting about Sonny, and this we can connect this to his upbringing, Harlem was filled with great intellectuals. It seems to me that all the great black intellectuals of the world somehow ended up in Harlem. And it was like the headquarters, if you will, the mecca of the black intelligentsia. And so
mm-hmm.
Sonny grew up in that environment. So Sonny is a true intellectual, I mean, and everything about him represents not only spirituality, but he's a true intellectual. Now, on the other hand, let's talk about Coltrane. Coltrane, and let me preface it also by saying this, that when I was a boy, I went to a very sophisticated Black Baptist church. And
mm-hmm.
a lot of heavy-duty people were there. They were all well-educated and, you know, Black royalty, if you will.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Now, but on my way to church, Ken, I would pass this sanctified church, and I heard people in there with, you know, banging drums and just, you know, really with the tambourines. And it was, like, really, really soulful. I mean, it was very sanctified. And it was this type of soulfulness, this earthiness, that attracted me to music initially. And to me, even to this day, when I listen to something, I want to hear how soulful it is. I want to hear if it's sanctified. I'm attracted to that sanctified sound. Now, Coltrane, and I know this, and I'm not as confident about everything I talked about, but this I am very confident about. Train, even though he was into Kriya Yoga and into different spirituality, forms of spirituality, Train was, to me, an old-fashioned holy roller. So when I
mm-hmm.
hear his music, I hear heavy-duty Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, I hear the strong Indian influences,
mm-hmm.
but what's most important is I hear Mahalia Jackson, you know, I hear Aretha Franklin, you know, and I hear these things in Train, and I don't hear as much of them in Sonny as I do in Train. And I think
mm-hmm.
that's
mm-hmm.
one reason, you know, Train you've got these two elements. Now, I think from a technical perspective, and Sonny probably would want to kill me after saying all of this, but I think technically Sonny could probably outblow all of it. I mean, the man has some technical facility. And by the way, getting back to your very valid earlier point, Ken, when you said it's about practice.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Sonny practiced the way an intellectual would practice, you know, and he understood how the need to practice and understand these different, I mean, music is very serious business, harmony and,
mm-hmm.
and structure. And by the way, these are the things that Mary Lou brought to the table. She gave these musicians a sense of structure.
Yep.
Now, it's true that most of the bebop musicians were kind of freeform people, even long before the freeform people of the 60s. But mm-hmm. she gave them a kind of discipline, a kind of her own spirituality. And what's interesting is that she could relate to them on different fronts. She was a heavy-duty Catholic. And, you know, we don't want to rule out the greatness of Catholic meditation and mysticism. It's very heavy. So I guess the point of my book, Ken, is to acknowledge one point that Sonny constantly makes. There is only one truth. And that, in effect, hopefully summarizes my book. It summarizes all people. It shows the beauty of all these different religions. And let me stop talking so much. I'm talking to death.
I think listeners can tell there's a lot behind this book. And it's, again, I had a great time reading it. It takes Sonny Rollins' life from his early family life straight through to growing up on the streets, his experiences hanging out with his mentor, Thelonious Monk, him becoming an artist in his own right, the really severe difficulties that he and many, 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 many other jazz musicians of the era had with drugs, him coming through the other side, that heroic time he spent on the bridge, basically reinventing himself, something that only the great artists have the courage to do. Most of us, we figure out a riff and we stick with it, you know? And right. And then the idea of saying, no, I'm gonna go and I'm gonna step back and dig even deeper. And then his success as a world figure, which he truly became, his experiences in Japan, and then running through it all, his connection to spirituality is all in this book, Sonny Rollins, Meditating on a Riff, A Journey into His World of Spirituality by Hugh Wyatt. You're going to learn a lot about a great artist. You're going to learn a lot about jazz. You're going to learn a lot about creativity and American music in this book. This is produced by Kamama Books.
Kamama Books. That's a Cherokee
Kamama
word.
Books.
Yeah, it means butterfly or elephant.
Ah, okay. And how Kamama. Can people, what's the easiest way for someone to get this book?
They can Google it, go online. It's all over the internet.
So they can.
And if they want to send they could contact Amanda at Kamama Books. Shall I give you the number?
Anything you want. Yeah.
212-983-3525, and Amanda can mail them copies of the book, but they could just go online. It's and soon it will be at Barnes & Noble, but, you know, and if people want to personally talk to me, 917-499-4040, you know, I'd be happy to talk to them, especially for those who are disgruntled, and I can tell you now, there will be some disgruntled people because some people will say, Hugh, you're taking sides with Sonny Rollins over Coltrane. How dare you?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm not taking sides so much, Ken, as I'm trying to make a logical analysis of both men.
Yeah. Hey, we're allowed to talk about our opinions of the music, and everybody's entitled to their opinion, and you know, that's how we learn, by comparing things and people and approaches. Well, great. So you have a website that is Kamama?
Kamama Books,
yes. Kamama Books.
K-A-M-A-M-A. Kamama. K-A-M-A-M-A. Uh-huh. Kamama Books.
Sounds great. Kamamabooks.com. Yeah. Or you could just go to, you know, Amazon or one of those places and type in Sonny Rollins, Meditating on a Riff, Hugh Wyatt, and you'll be able to get the book. And really, if you're a jazz fan, if you're a Sonny Rollins fan, which most of us are, you know, you got to get this book. But if you're a jazz fan, or if you're just somebody, at a minimum, you're interested in American culture and how we developed the culture that we developed, which is so unique in the world. Well, it's the product of unique human beings with remarkable qualities. And one of those people, unique human beings with remarkable qualities, was Sonny Rollins. And his life is captured beautifully in this book by Hugh Wyatt, Sonny Rollins, Meditating on a Riff. Hugh, we're going to have you back. We're going to have to talk about a lot more things.
ready whenever you are.
Okay.
Jazz has been the most important thing in my life, other than, of course, God, the Creator, and my family. But after them, you know, jazz is, I'm still fascinated. I've been listening to it since I was 7 or 8 years old, and I'm still listening every day now. And I appreciate, and your knowledge, Ken, of the music. You are really an expert, and I feel honored to have been interviewed by you and for someone who knows so much about the music and the culture. And so I'm the one who's really humbled by your interviewing me. Thank you.
Oh, well, we're going to be equal on that point. I'm honored as well to meet you and looking forward to more conversations.
Okay, thanks very much. And just let me know when, Ken.
Okay.
Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you did, please share it. That's how we grow. And remember to subscribe to jazzonthetube.com, the internet's largest collection of free, streamable, classic jazz videos.